content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the September 25th, 2015 issue of The Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. Republicans divided on shutdown threat. What happened? Congressional Republican leaders were struggling to regain control over their party this week as a group of conservative lawmakers threatened to shut down the government over the continued federal funding of Planned Parenthood. Several senators and 28 House Republicans have pledged to block any budget measure that includes financing for the National Women's Health Group, which has been the subject of a series of sting videos in which its officials blithely discussed the harvesting of organs from aborted fetuses. Funding for the federal government expires on September 30th, and Congress must renew it to avoid a shutdown. Democrats would block any legislation defunding Planned Parenthood through either a Senate filibuster or a presidential veto. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell described his fellow Republicans' attempts to defund the Women's Health Organization as an exercise in futility, saying, "That's not going to happen until you have a president who has a similar view." Led by Senator Ted Cruz and other architects of the 2013 shutdown over the Affordable Care Act, conservative lawmakers remained defiant. Cruz called Planned Parenthood a criminal enterprise and said that if Obama vetoes a spending bill that defunds the organization, a government shutdown would be his fault. Several House members reportedly threatened to overthrow House Speaker John Boehner if he doesn't at least mount a defunding effort. "If Republicans can't fight against the sale of dead baby parts," said Representative Mick Mulvaney, "then we can't fight for anything." What the editorial said: "The shutdown zealots' strategy lacks even a small chance of success," said the Wall Street Journal. "They think if they stand up and fight, more people will see these horrific videos and public opinion will turn against President Obama. In reality, a political standoff will focus attention on the shutdown, not the videos. As was the case in 2013, the GOP will take the blame and its approval ratings will sink even further. That will make it harder to elect a Republican to the White House next year, which will only hurt the anti-abortion cause." "It's a disgrace Planned Parenthood is under attack at all," said the Boston Globe. "By law, the group cannot spend any of its $500 million of annual federal funding on abortions. That money goes to providing cancer screenings, contraception, and other critical services to mainly lower-income women. Nor does Planned Parenthood sell any fetal tissue. They donate it to medical researchers who use it to develop the polio vaccine and are now trying to find potential treatments for cancer, HIV, Parkinson's, autism, and other afflictions." What the columnist said: "Boehner is stuck between a rock and a hard place," said Steve Bannon in MSNBC.com. "Accede to the base's wishes and he'll cause a damaging shutdown that could cost the party the 2016 election. Pass on a clean spending bill to the Senate and he could be toppled by his own party. Does he try to keep his job or do his job?" "The GOP probably can't defund Planned Parenthood this time," said David Harsanyi in NationalReview.com. "But policy change usually happens incrementally, and getting this story onto the front pages would help the pro-life cause. McConnell gave up too easily. By saying he was trying to avoid a shutdown, he essentially conceded that the GOP is culpable for any shutdowns. And remember, it was only a year after the last shutdown that the party had a sweeping victory in the midterm elections. GOP leaders should stop being cowards. Why does the shutdown folly repeat itself year after year? Asked Jim Newell in Slate.com. Because everyone involved is acting logically in his own interests. Cruz is drawing attention to his presidential campaign and courting the evangelical vote. His House collaborators are protecting themselves from potential right-wing challengers in their districts. In the end, Boehner will have to buy some Democratic votes with some concessions. Congress will pass a clean spending bill. Cruz will make a long, pompous speech. And Democrats will keep Planned Parenthood funded. Reason prevails in its own politically refracted way. And a second main story this week. Europe overwhelmed by the flow of refugees. What happened? Governments across Europe implemented emergency border clampdowns this week to try to stem the tide of migrants arriving from the Middle East, Africa, and elsewhere, leading to violent scenes at Hungary's borders with Serbia. After a record 9,380 migrants entered Hungary in a single day, Budapest declared a state of emergency, sealing its border with a 190-mile razor wire fence and promising to prosecute anyone who breached the barrier. Trapped in a no-man's land between Hungarian and Serbian checkpoints, hundreds of migrants chanted, "Open, open, open," and were forced back from the fence by Hungarian police using tear gas and water cannons. Others headed to neighboring Croatia, crossing a border region still dotted with landmines from the Balkan Wars. Days after pledging to accept 800,000 refugees, Germany also temporarily introduced its own emergency border checks. Austria and the Netherlands quickly implemented similar measures. The move created bottlenecks of migrants to the east and was widely seen as an attempt by Berlin to pressure reluctant Eastern European countries into offering asylum to more refugees. Western Europeans, said German Chancellor Angela Merkel, cannot solve the problem on their own. What the columnist said. When Mama Merkel invited refugees into Germany last week, said Matthew Karnickschnig in Politico.com, the country briefly basked in a fairy tale glow. Germany, long seen as a scold for its hard line on the Greek economic crisis, was now portrayed as Europe's warm and caring leader. Then reality set in. At least 40,000 migrants answered Merkel's offer of hospitality in the first weekend alone, overwhelming authorities in Germany's 16 states. Yet Eastern Europeans won't lessen the load, said Joshua Keating in Slate.com. In Hungary, Slovakia, and the Czech Republic, residents gripe about fake asylum seekers and hold signs reading, "Today's refugees, tomorrow's terrorists." But you can't entirely blame them for resisting calls by European Union officials for each EU member to have a mandatory migrant quota. These countries have suffered years of economic difficulties since joining the EU and are resentful of being lectured by their wealthier Western European counterparts. Still, they've got a short-term memory, said the New York Times in an editorial. It wasn't long ago that Eastern Europeans were the ones welcoming Europe's embrace, having broken free from decades of communist dictatorship. But Europe can't operate an open-door policy, said Walter Russell Mead in the Wall Street Journal. This is unlikely to be the last migration crisis of the 21st century. Today, many migrants come from Syria, but endless ethnic violence across the Middle East and sub-Saharan Africa could generate millions more refugees in the coming years, from Egypt or Turkey or Lebanon. Welcoming tens of thousands of asylum seekers is one thing. 10 million is another. Our controversy of the week, Iran deal. Should Republicans keep fighting? President Obama finally has his nuclear deal with Iran, said Charles Krauthammer in the Washington Post. But the way he got it should fill Democrats with shame and revulsion. Not only did Obama deny Congress a proper vote on an issue of the utmost strategic significance and geopolitical gravity by the trick of calling it an agreement rather than a treaty, but in the end, 42 Senate Democrats filibustered Congress's resolution of disapproval, sparing their dear leader the further embarrassment of a veto. History won't forgive Obama for this disaster, said DeRoy Murdoch in NationalReview.com. For the sake of his priceless legacy bubble, sanctions will soon be relaxed on Iran, freeing up an immediate $150 billion for the mullahs to distribute among Hezbollah and other terrorist proxies. In return, the U.S. got a dubious inspections program to keep Iran from pursuing nuclear weapons, and the deal expires in 15 years. On the eve of Obama's hollow victory last week, Iran's Ayatollah Ali Khamenei issued a chilling prediction that Israel won't exist in 25 years and contemptuously referred to the U.S. as Satan. Some victory. Obama's critics are unhinged, said Steve Chapman in Reason.com. They insist that this deal represents a craven surrender to Iran that will surely lead to a genocidal attack on Tel Aviv. But if Obama simply wanted to appease Iran, why did he hammer out a complex deal over 2 years of contentious negotiations, bring in nuclear experts to fine-tune technical details, and create a vigorous inspection scheme praised by dozens of former generals and intelligence officials? Conservatives are spluttering in impotent rage, said David Ignatius in the Washington Post, because Obama has outfoxed them at nearly every turn. Despite a sabotage attempt by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and congressional Republicans, the president forged a deal that most international strategists and even Israel's national security establishment regard as preferable to any realistic alternative. Whether Iran complies remains to be seen, but for Obama, this already counts as the most determined strategic success of his presidency. Congress can't actually stop Obama from acting as if the deal is legal, said Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. But Republicans need to keep fighting. The 2015 law requiring congressional review of the deal stipulates that every aspect of the agreement with Iran be disclosed to Congress. But some provisions of the inspection regime between Iran and the International Atomic Energy Agency remain secret. That means the 60-day review period hasn't legally begun, and Republicans should keep trying to vote their disapproval. Congress can take other steps, said Michael Mukasey in the Wall Street Journal, including authorizing the use of military force against Iran in the likely event that the mullahs are found to be cheating. But for that authorization to have any meaning, we'll need a president with enough steel to do more than talk about bombing Iran. Conservatives can't be expected to stop criticizing a deal they abhor, said Doyle McManus in the Los Angeles Times. But they ought to give it a chance to succeed. If the Iranians do cheat and try to build a nuclear bomb, we can always go to war. And if they don't cheat, the big question is what kind of Iran the U.S. will face in 15 years, when Khamenei is dead and a new pro-Western generation of Iranians moves into power. Will Iran move in a more moderate direction, having seen that renouncing nuclear weapons was a good decision? There's only one way to find out. It was a good week for the right to vent. after a federal judge upheld a citizen's First Amendment right to use profanity when paying a speeding ticket. William Barboza had been arrested and briefly jailed in Liberty, New York, after he wrote an F-bomb on the payment form and changed the town's name from Liberty to Tyranny. It was a good week for casting a wide net after lawyers for Guantanamo Bay inmate Muhammad Rahim al-Afghani revealed that he has a dating profile on Match.com with the tagline, "Detained but ready to mingle." He gets matches every day, the lawyer said, and he finds that hilarious. It was a good week for emotional range after Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg said the social media site would soon launch a dislike button to enable users to express empathy when a friend shares sad news. "Not every moment is a good moment," Zuckerberg explained. But it was a bad week for pop diplomacy after Sir Elton John thanked Russian President Vladimir Putin on Instagram for reaching out in a phone conversation to discuss gay rights. The Kremlin promptly denied the call took place and suggested that the singer was the victim of a hoax. It was a bad week for hard evidence after a Chinese woman accused of stealing a $400,000 diamond from a Bangkok store was forced to undergo a colonoscopy. The 6-carat stone was found in her large intestine. And it was a bad week for ungodly dress after a councilman in Dadeville, Alabama, introduced a town ordinance banning sagging pants. "I prayed about this," Frank Goodman said. "I know God would not go around with his pants down." We're on the briefing page now. The end of smoking. At one time, half the U.S. population smoked. Today, most smokers have quit. What happened? How many people smoke today? In the U.S., just 17.8% of the population smokes, a record low and down from a peak of more than 50% in the 1950s. Punishing taxes, indoor smoking bans, and gruesome ad campaigns have compelled smokers to quit at such a rate that Citigroup analysts predict their numbers could drop to nearly zero by 2050. This decline is largely the result of a remarkable change in public perception of smoking, which the tobacco industry has successfully portrayed as cool and rebellious, a mark of sophistication and maturity. Now, smokers are largely pariahs, and smoking is widely seen as a dangerous, dirty, and disgusting habit. 50 years ago, everyone around me smoked, says photo developer Barry Blackwell, 60. Everyone. Now, looking down on smokers is one of the few socially acceptable prejudices left. Why have smoking rates dropped so dramatically? Fewer teens are starting to smoke in the first place, which helps. But a wave of state and city smoking bans for indoor spaces, including offices, restaurants, and bars, have also made it increasingly inconvenient for existing smokers to light up outside the home. In the aftermath of those bans, a 2012 study showed hospitalizations for heart attacks and strokes fell at least 15%. The public smoking bans did not merely force smokers to light up at home, as many health officials first feared, but have actually encouraged large numbers to kick the habit entirely. The percentage of smoke-free homes in Minnesota, following bans on restaurant, bar, and workplace smoking, for example, grew from 64.5% in 1999 to 87.2% in 2010. What about ad campaigns? Television ads have proved a hugely successful way of rebranding smoking. One campaign in particular terrified huge numbers of smokers into chucking away their cigarettes. The 2012 Tips from Former Smokers campaign by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, which featured harrowing videos of people who developed cancer, diabetes, emphysema, and other diseases as a result of smoking. "During radiation treatments, I'm still smoking because I'm that addicted," said one of the former smokers, who had a mechanical voice and prominent tracheotomy hole in his throat. "It wasn't until they took out my voice box and I breathed through a hole in my neck that I finally quit." In the 3 months after these ads aired, 200,000 Americans quit smoking. CDC Director Tom Frieden says the ads represented a David versus Goliath victory against the tobacco industry, which spends about $8 billion annually marketing its products. "Because we have truth on our side," said Frieden, "these ads make a difference." Do cigarette taxes help? Hitting smokers in the wallet has proved the most effective strategy. In 2009, President Obama signed a historic federal tax hike that raised cigarette prices 22% overnight. The following year, 3 million fewer people said they smoked. These days, smoking is a very expensive habit to have. In New York City, the average price of a single pack of cigarettes is $13. Hardcore smokers who can withstand smoking bans and ad campaigns about smoking's dangers find it harder to ignore cost considerations, said Dr. Mary O'Sullivan, director of the Margarita Kempchi Smoking Cessation Program. "Even our schizophrenia patients, who are the most addicted, who used to smoke 2 and 3 packs a day, even they are smoking less because of the price," O'Sullivan told the New York Times. Is smoking dying out everywhere? Unfortunately, no. In the developing world, the trend has been exactly the reverse. Tobacco consumption more than doubled between 1970 and 2000, and 3/4 of the world's smokers now live in developing countries such as Nigeria, India, and China. Tobacco companies have flocked to these countries to boost profits, and governments in the region are profiting from the trend. In China, home of 340 million smokers, cigarette taxes generate up to 10% of the total annual central government revenues. In the long run, however, the huge health costs of treating hundreds of millions of smokers who are sure to catch up with China and other countries, and they will probably follow the West's lead in trying to discourage smoking. What's the future of smoking? It's not dead yet. Even after decades of decline in the U.S., 42 million people still smoke, and smoking causes 500,000 deaths a year. And while smoking rates dropped 62% among high-income families from 1965 to 1999, they dropped only 9% among low-income families. Trends suggest that the number of smokers will continue to creep down. Regulations that lower the amount of nicotine in cigarettes could help speed up that process. But unless the government makes smoking illegal, millions will continue to smoke. As epidemiologist Catherine Hill points out, only 70% of current smokers say they actually want to quit. Ambitious goals for a smoke-free society, she says, do not take this simple fact of life into account. E-cigs, the next generation's habit. For today's teenagers, smoking cigarettes is no longer a widespread rite of passage. More of them smoke marijuana than tobacco, and a growing number are attracted to e-cigarettes, battery-powered handheld devices that heat up nicotine-laced fluid, vaporizing it for users to inhale. As teen cigarette use has dropped from 23% in 2000 to 9% today, e-cig experimentation among high schoolers has soared, tripling in just 1 year to 13%. In theory, that could be a good thing. E-cigs are tobacco and smoke-free, so they don't cause the severe lung damage of cigarettes. Though studies have found formaldehyde, benzene, and other toxins in the device's secondhand vapor. But a recent study found that e-cigs can start teens down the road to regular cigarette use, since they, too, get people addicted to nicotine. While e-cigarettes may potentially represent a product that can reduce harm for established cigarette smokers, the study authors said, they may simultaneously contribute to the development of a new population of cigarette smokers. And we'll take a look at a few columns now. The first comes from the U.S., The Psychic Suffering of World War II Vets. Post-traumatic stress disorder did not start with the Vietnam or Iraq War, said Tim Madigan. As I learned while doing research for a novel on World War II veterans, more than 1 million Americans who fought in that conflict were discharged for psychoneurotic disorders. By 1947, nearly half of the beds in Veterans Administration hospitals were filled with men with PTSD. A suppressed 1946 documentary by director John Huston reported that 20% of U.S. casualties suffered primarily psychic, not physical, wounds that left them with night terrors, survivor's guilt, depression, and alcoholism. The brutal reality of what World War II did to veteran psyches has been lost amid the mythology of the Greatest Generation. But with the PTSD now out in the open, the remaining survivors of World War II are finally talking about their lingering symptoms, which have followed them into their 80s and 90s. The deepest wound was right here, one veteran, Earl Crumby, told me as he pointed to his head. Another veteran, Otis Mackey, said, "When we got out, you couldn't talk about things like that. Instead, he and others suffered in silence, convinced they were alone. But even the good war did terrible things to those who fought it." This column comes from the UK. You can't share power without trust. Northern Ireland has proved that it can't govern itself, said Malachy O'Doherty. The power-sharing deal that has allowed largely Protestant, Unionist, and Catholic Republicans to run the province since 1998 has all but collapsed. And Northern Ireland's first minister, Peter Robinson, has resigned. The crisis came because Unionists were freaked by the disclosure that the IRA still exists with a command structure and access to guns. Police say IRA members murdered one of their own, a former assassin who'd gone rogue in August. They arrested three top Republicans, including Bobby Storey, the chairman of Sinn Féin, the IRA's former political wing, and a confidant of party leader Jerry Adams. Outraged, a small Unionist party pulled its one minister from government, and though Robinson didn't withdraw his Democratic Unionist, he resigned, saying the continued existence of the IRA has pushed devolution to the brink. In fact, it was already teetering before the murder. The two sides haven't been able to agree on the most basic points of government, such as passing a budget. UK Prime Minister David Cameron should suspend devolution now and let Parliament run Northern Ireland as it does in England and Wales. If Republicans and Unionists can't rule together, and neither will trust the other to govern alone, neither should govern at all. And this from Israel. Prepare for a Muslim Europe. Whether out of innocence or out of foolishness, Europe has just volunteered to destroy its own culture, said Noah Kleger. By opening its borders to hundreds of thousands of Muslim refugees, the European Union has guaranteed that within a few decades, we will witness the establishment of an Islamic rule across the entire continent. This should have been clear to Germany, which has already failed to integrate hundreds of thousands of Turkish migrant workers. Even after they were in Germany for decades, the Turks kept their language and their traditions, including vendettas and honor killing. France and Sweden also have problems with the Muslim minorities already on their soil. And those are the rich countries. The EU thinks it can disperse refugees among all its members, but it's far from assured that Eastern countries like Poland or the Czech Republic will agree. And we can assume that not a single refugee will agree to settle in countries like Bulgaria and Romania, which are among the poorest in Europe. Instead, they will cluster in Germany and France and multiply as their birth rate far outstrips that of the natives. The result will be the complete disappearance of the tradition, culture, and progress of Western Europe. And we turn now to the last word. Our in-depth article this week is titled, What Do Animals Think? Scientists are trained to believe that the animal mind is unknowable, said Carl Safina. They should look closer. Science usually steers firmly away from questions about the inner lives of animals. Surely they have inner lives of some sort. But like a child who is admonished that what he really wants to ask is impolite, a young scientist is taught that the animal mind, if there is such a thing, is unknowable. Permissible questions are it questions about where it lives, what it eats, what it does when danger threatens, how it breeds. But always forbidden is the one question that might open the door. Who? Who animals know who they are? They know who their family and friends are. They know their enemies. They make strategic alliances and cope with chronic rivalries. They aspire to higher rank and wait for their chance to challenge the existing order. Their status affects their offspring's prospects. Their life follows the arc of a career. Personal relationships define them. Sound familiar? Of course. They include us. But a vivid, familiar life is not the domain of humans alone. I traveled to observe some of the most protected creatures in the world. The elephants of Amboseli in Kenya, the wolves of Yellowstone in the United States, and the killer whales in the waters of the Pacific Northwest. And in each place, I found the animals feeling human pressures that directly affect what they do, where they go, how long they live, and how their families fare. Do other animals have human emotions? Yes, they do. Do humans have animal emotions? Yes, they're largely the same. Fear, aggression, well-being, anxiety, and pleasure are the emotions of shared brain structures and shared chemistries, originated in shared ancestry. They are the shared feelings of a shared world. The wolves of Yellowstone National Park's Lamar Valley attract human attention as nowhere else. The alpha wolf watcher, Rick McIntyre, follows wolves here every day. I don't mean 5 days a week or weather permitting. I mean that every day for 15 years so far, Rick McIntyre has been in the Lamar Valley. No misses. A man in his mid-60s, of angular features, Rick has had his eye on wild wolves for more hours than any human ever has. Quite possibly more than any living creature that isn't a wolf. Rick can glance through a telescope at a wolf on a ridge a mile away and instantly tell you who it is by name and recite its life. As Rick sees it, wolves and humans must deal with similar life problems, such as figuring out when to face the risks of leaving home, finding your place in the world. There are endless similarities, he says. He notes, though, one difference between wolves and himself. Certain wolves I've known, they were better at being a wolf than I've been at being a person. And if there ever was a perfect wolf, Rick said, it was 21. He was like a fictional character, but he was real. Even from a distance, 21's big shoulder profile was recognizable. Utterly fearless in defense of his family, 21 had the size, strength, and agility to win against overwhelming odds. On two occasions, I saw 21 take on 6 attacking wolves and rout them all, Rick says. It was like watching Muhammad Ali or Michael Jordan, a one-of-a-kind talent at the top of his game, the extreme high end of the skill set, talent outside of normal. 21 came into the world in the first litter of pups born in Yellowstone in nearly 70 years. His parents had both been trapped alive in Canada and shipped to Yellowstone, specifically to reintroduce wolves into a system that had gotten out of balance, with too many elk for the land to bear. After almost 70 years without wolves, the elk had built to such numbers that winter for them meant scarcity and hunger. For the introduced wolves, though, the imbalance meant plenty of food. But even though wolves had been absent longer than most people could remember, just before 21 was born, someone shot his father. A wolf does not do well as a single mother, so researchers reluctantly decided to capture 21's mother and her pups and feed them for a few months in a one-acre pen. When humans brought food to the pen, all of the wolves fled to the opposite fence except for one pup, who would pace a little rise in the enclosure, putting himself between the humans and the rest of his family. The pup would later be given the tracking collar number 21. At age 2.5, 21 left his mother, his adoptive father, and his birth pack. 21 waltzed into the family known as the Druid Peak Pack less than 2 days after the Druid's alpha male had also illegally been shot. The Druid females welcomed this prime male wolf. Their pups loved the big new guy. He adopted the pups and helped feed them. With no hassle at all, 21 had left home and immediately become the alpha male of an established pack. It was his big break in life. 21 was remarkably gentle with the members of his pack, says Rick. Immediately after making a kill, he would often walk away to urinate or lie down and nap, allowing family members who'd had nothing to do with the hunt to eat their fill. One of 21's favorite things was to wrestle with little pups. And what he really loved to do, Rick adds, was to pretend to lose. He just got a huge kick out of it. Here was this great big male wolf, and he'd let some little wolf jump on him and bite his fur. He'd just fall on his back with his paws in the air, Rick half mimes. And the triumphant-looking little one would be standing over him with his tail wagging. The ability to pretend, Rick adds, shows that you understand how your actions are perceived by others. It indicates high intelligence. I'm sure the pups knew what was going on, but it was a way for them to learn how it feels to conquer something much bigger than you. And that kind of confidence is what wolves need every day of their hunting lives. Early in 21's run as an alpha, 3 females in his pack gave birth. That was extraordinary. Usually only the alpha female or matriarch breeds. The 3 litters reflected the unnaturally abundant food supply. An astounding 20 pups survived, swelling an already large pack to a hard-to-believe 37 wolves, the largest ever documented. Because the pack size resulted from a food base so artificially swollen after 7 decades devoid of wolves, the 3-dozen member pack might have been the world's all-time largest. Only 21 had what it took to run an outfit that large, Rick comments. It wasn't all peaceful. The high density of wolves likely produced unnaturally high wolf-on-wolf conflict. In territorial defense and in pursuit of expanded territory, 21 participated in plenty of fights. Wolf territorial fights resemble human tribal warfare. When packs fight, numbers count, but experience matters an awful lot. Juveniles can seem lost in the confusion. Wolves often target the alphas of the rival pack, as if they fully understand that if they can rout or kill the experienced leaders, victory will be theirs. The second most common cause of wolf deaths in the Rockies is getting killed by other wolves. Getting killed by humans is first. 21 distinguished himself in two ways. He never lost a fight, and he never killed a vanquished wolf. 21's restraint in letting vanquished rivals go free seems incredible. What could it be? Mercy? Another term for a person who does not press an advantage against a threatened opponent is magnanimous. Can a wolf be magnanimous? And if so, why? In 21's life, there was a particular male, a sort of roving Casanova, a continual annoyance. He was strikingly good-looking, had a big personality, and was always doing something interesting. The best single word is charisma, says Rick. Female wolves were happy to mate with him. People loved him. His irresponsibility and infidelity, it didn't matter. One day, 21 discovered this Casanova among his daughters. 21 ran in, caught him, and began biting and pinning him to the ground. Various pack members piled in, beating Casanova up. Casanova was also big, Rick says, but he was a bad fighter. Now he was totally overwhelmed, and the pack was finally killing him. Suddenly, 21 steps back. Everything stops. The pack members are looking at 21 as if saying, "Why has Dad stopped?" The Casanova wolf jumped up and, as always in such situations, ran away. But Casanova kept causing problems for 21. Why didn't 21 just kill him so he wouldn't have to deal with him anymore? It didn't make sense until years later. Fast forward to after 21's death. Casanova briefly became the Druid pack's alpha male. But he wasn't effective, Rick recalls. He didn't know what to do. Just not a leader personality. And although it's very rare for a younger brother to depose an older one, that's what happened to him. Casanova didn't mind. It meant he was free to wander and meet other females. Eventually, Casanova, along with several young Druid males, met some females, and they all formed another pack. With them, Rick remembers, he finally became the model of a responsible alpha male and a great father. Meanwhile, the mighty Druids were ravaged and weakened by mange and diminished by inter-pack fighting. The last Druid was shot near Butte, Montana in 2010. Casanova, though, he'd been averse to fighting, died in a fight with a rival pack. But everyone in his pack remained uninjured, including grandchildren and great-grandchildren of 21. Wolves can't foresee such plot twists any more than people can, but evolution does. Its calculus integrates long averages. By sparing the Casanova wolf, 21 actually helped assure himself more surviving descendants. And in evolution, surviving descendants are the only currency that matters. So in strictly survivalist terms, should a wolf let his rival go free? Is restraint an effective strategy for accumulating benefits? I think the answer is yes, if you can afford it, because sometimes your enemy today becomes tomorrow a vehicle for your legacy. What Rick saw play out over those years might be just the kinds of events that are the basis for magnanimity in wolves and at the heart of mercy in men. Early on, when 21 was young and still living with his mother and adoptive father, One of their new pups was not acting normal. The other pups were a bit afraid of him and wouldn't play with him. One day, 21 brought back some food for the small pups, and after feeding them, he just stood there, looking around for something. Soon he started wagging his tail. He'd been looking for the sickly little pup, Rick says, and finding him, he just went over to hang out with him for a while. Rick suddenly seems to be searching inside himself for something deeper he wants to express. Then he looks at me, saying simply, "Of all the stories I have about 21, that's my favorite." Strength impresses us, but what we remember is kindness. The majority of wolves die violently. Despite a violent, eventful life, even by wolf standards, 21 distinguished himself to the very end. He was a black wolf who grayed with the years and became one of the few Yellowstone wolves to die of old age. One June day, when 21 was 9 years old, his family was lying bedded down when an elk came by. Everyone jumped up to give chase. He jumped up too, but just stood watching the action and then lay down again. Later, when the pack headed up toward the den site, 21 crossed the valley in the opposite direction, traveling purposefully somewhere alone. Sometime later, a visitor who'd been way up high in the backcountry reported having seen something very unusual, a dead wolf. Rick got a horse and rode up to investigate. That last day, it seems, 21 knew his time had come. He used the last of his energy to go up to the top of a high mountain. In a favorite family rendezvous site, where he'd been with his pups year after year, amid high summer grass and mountain wildflowers, 21 curled up in the shade of a big tree. And on his own terms, he went to sleep for the last time. This was excerpted from Beyond Words, What Animals Think and Feel, by Carl Safina. On the Health and Science page, a surprising new human ancestor. Deep inside a South African cave, paleontologists have unearthed a rich mine of bones that herald a new species of human ancestor. The age of the fossils has yet to be determined by carbon dating, but scientists believe the hominins are from the earliest phase of the emergence of human-like creatures, about 2.5 million years ago. Dubbed Homo naledi, our ancient relative appears to have been a primitive, transitional figure in the evolutionary scheme. But it also has some surprisingly human-like features, enough to warrant placing it in the genus Homo, paleoanthropologist John Hawks tells CNN.com. Roughly 5 feet tall, Homo naledi had a small brain, about the size of an orange, and ape-like shoulders with hands that allowed it to climb and swing from trees, but also feet and legs that enabled it to walk upright. Even more striking than the fossils themselves is the way they were arrayed when South African geologist Lee Berger found them in Rising Star Cave outside Johannesburg. The remains, which include at least 15 distinct individuals, were grouped in an isolated chamber 100 yards underground that suggests Homo naledi used a site as a burial ground, a practice thought to be uniquely human, Berger says. But we have just encountered another species that perhaps thought about its own mortality and went to great risk and effort to dispose of its dead. It absolutely questions what makes us human. Sperm whale dialects. Virtually all human languages have dialects that vary among regions and social groups, and the same goes for sperm whales, new research suggests. The vast, deep-diving mammals are intensely social, forming stable clans and that communicate through learned patterns of distinct vocal clicks that vary in rhythm and tempo and sound a bit like Morse code. Like human societies, clans communicating with different dialects have their own unique interactions, NatureWorldNews.com reports. After closely monitoring sperm whales swimming off the Galapagos Islands in the eastern Pacific Ocean, the researchers found that when clans communicated differently, they also behaved differently. For example, in the way they migrated, hunted, or cared for their young. Using computer models and data from 18 years of observations, the researchers determined these dialects were not innate or passed down genetically, but the result of social learning among the whales. This gives us evidence that key features of human culture, which we think makes us so different from everything else in nature, might be at play in populations of other animals, says study author Mauricio Cantor. Maybe we're not as different as we thought. On the Talking Points page, Syria, Putin's next foreign adventure. For 70 years, American presidents from both parties have sought to thwart Russian influence in the Middle East, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial, but not President Obama. In recent weeks, Moscow has deployed tanks, troops, and equipment in civil war-torn Syria, establishing a new operating base at an airfield near Mediterranean city of Latakia. The Kremlin is openly admitting it plans to prop up the faltering regime of its ally, Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, who is struggling in ongoing battles with Western-backed rebels, the Al-Qaeda-linked Nusra Front, and the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. Yet rather than countering this troubling intervention, Obama reportedly will let Russian President Vladimir Putin get away with keeping Syria's blood-soaked dictator in power to ensure that ISIS doesn't conquer Syria. The cost of Obama's passivity will be steep, said Lee Smith in the Weekly Standard. Putin aims to replace the U.S. as the dominant power in the Middle East. Actually, U.S. officials are probably high-fiving each other over Russia's action, said Malik Kalin in Forbes.com. Obama originally decided to avoid military involvement in Syria based on the assumption that nobody is going to make order out of chaos there for a generation. If Putin wants to blunder into the same catastrophic cul-de-sac as we did in Iraq, let him. The Russian leader isn't naive, said Leonid Beshidsky in BloombergView.com. He knows Western powers will never join him in backing Assad, whom they see as almost as bad as the ISIS fanatics, and that taking on ISIS without international support would be a huge risk. Putin is more likely to confine Russia's intervention to helping Assad stay in power with arms and troop training rather than try to conquer and occupy Syria. Whatever happens, Syria will be the biggest blot on the Obama presidency, said Roger Cohen in the New York Times. The ongoing four-and-a-half-year conflict has left 250,000 Syrians dead, displaced 4 million others, and given ISIS a seemingly impenetrable stronghold. Obama could have used American power to declare a no-fly zone and stop Syrian aircraft from dropping barrel bombs on civilians. He could have created a safe area for refugees. Instead, he did nothing. What's happening in Syria now is irrefutable evidence that while American interventionism can have terrible consequences, non-interventionism can be equally devastating. And a few short notes. The civil war in Syria has uprooted 49% of the country's population. If the same happened in the U.S., that would be about 158 million people, the equivalent of every man, woman, and child in 29 states. At least 66 Americans have been accused of supporting the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria since the beginning of 2014. Most were charged with planning to join the caliphate in the Middle East. 10 were women, and at least 7 were people accused of plotting terrorist attacks at home. More than half the students at 347 colleges and vocational schools failed to pay back any of their student loans after 7 years. Even so, students at these schools, most of them for-profit institutions, received $2.2 billion in federal loans last year. 10 years after graduation, alumni of Ivy League schools have average incomes of more than $70,000 a year, double the average income of graduates of all other colleges. For the top 10% of the Ivy League grads, the average income 10 years after graduation is more than $200,000. The number of executions in the U.S. dropped from 98 in 1999 to 35 last year, and to 20 in the first 8 months of this year, 16 of them in just two states, Texas and Missouri. In Texas, not a single person has been sentenced to death in 2015. On the poll watch, 71% of Americans think Congress should approve a budget in order to avoid a government shutdown, while just 22% think it's more important to eliminate all federal funding for Planned Parenthood. And we'll take a quote in from William F. Buckley to finish out the hour. Idealism is fine, but as it approaches reality, the costs become prohibitive. We've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138.